Okay. Now we want to move into item number 8, the Clawcom Elk briefing. Will Moore, wildlife biologist, Region 3, and Scott McCorkadale, our deer and elk specialist. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the Commission, appreciate the opportunity to be here today. We're here at the request of the Commission to receive an update on Clawcom Elk Herd management and some of the sort of ongoing issues with Clawcom Elk Herd. My name is Scott McCorkadale. I'm the statewide deer and elk specialist in the wildlife program. I actually work out of the Yakima office, and I'm here with my colleague today, William Moore, who's the assistant district wildlife biologist for Kittitas and Yakima counties. The objectives of our presentation today include reviewing Clawcom Elk Herd management basics, summarizing recent efforts to improve Clawcom Elk Herd management, identify some ongoing management challenges that we have with this herd, and then to present a Clawcom roads modeling exercise. I'm going to be dealing with the first three elements there, and then William will be dealing with the last one. So the Clawcom Elk Herd is one of 10 recognized herds in the state. It's basically that herd that's outlined in the blue. It's pretty much in the central part of the state. Wenatchee is sort of off the north boundary of the herd area, and Yakima and Ellensburg are kind of to the south of the herd area. Just in terms of some landscape attributes, in case you're not familiar with this area, the core area for this herd is a relatively open landscape, relatively untimbered, as you can see in that photograph, the top one to the right. It's very well roaded and highly accessible. It's a multiple ownership landscape that involves some large public ownership by several agencies. Ours is one of them, so is the state DNR, as well as the Forest Service as you move to the west. The elk movement scale on this landscape is relative to something like the nearby Yakima herd is relatively modest, so the migration distances tend to be sort of smaller. Unlike the Yakima herd, it's a landscape for elk that has very little wilderness in the core area and roadless area. So again, the general nature of the area used by most of this herd is relatively roaded and relatively accessible. This area supports more than 40,000 elk hunter days per year in recent time. In terms of some herd management objectives, and these come from the Clawcom Elk Herd Plan, which you're probably familiar with, the population goal is to maintain a population of 4,500 elk plus or minus 5% in the surveyed portion of the winter range, and the metric is sort of measured in during February, March aerial surveys that we conduct every year. The post-hunt bull-cow ratio goal is to have 12 to 20 bulls per 100 cows in the spring. And we would like, according to the herd plan, and basically this is similar to other herd plans, to have 2 to 10% of the bull subpopulation consisting of mature bulls. We also would obviously like to minimize damage caused by elk and the complaints that we receive about elk damage. And then another major goal in the elk herd plan is to maintain and improve existing elk habitat on public land. This graph basically just shows recent trends in the elk population estimate for the Clawcom herd. We only started generating formal population estimates in 1999. That year was a bit of an experiment, so this graph shows the data from 2000 through the last spring, 2011. Fluctuating a little bit, but of late, in recent years, the trend has been upwards, and in fact, the last three population estimates have been within or slightly above the population objective for the herd. In fact, the last estimate this past spring put us about 100 elk over the population objective. It's actually a landscape that's fairly well suited to doing population surveys for elk. It's, again, a relatively open landscape. We encounter extremely large groups in the spring on this landscape. They're a bit challenging, as you might guess from looking at this photograph, to enumerate accurately. We've actually gone to a system to improve that, where these larger groups, we actually take high-definition digital photos and actually do the counting from those photos. By doing that, we found that before we were doing that, we had a strong, consistent tendency to underestimate the number of elk in such groups. This group actually has, in case you're curious, 441 elk in it, each one with an owl red dot on them. This is the data from the spring surveys. This is the calf recruitment data. And like pretty much all western elk herds, it basically fluctuates through time. The green bar across here is kind of a reference value. I mean, normally in managing elk, we would really like to see spring calf-cow ratio to be somewhere in that 30 or better range. And as you can see for the Clockham, sometimes we make that and sometimes we don't. We've had good years where we've had as many as 39 or 42 is the high on this time series, calves per 100 cows, and the 17, this was at the tail end of a really severe winter. In recent years, the last few years, we've been a little bit below what we'd like, but we've actually been on an increasing trend. And so the last year, this past spring, we had a ratio estimate of 27 calves per 100 cows. Clockham bull management has provided some challenges with this herd. This graph basically shows a reference value. This is the 12 level, so this would be the lower end of the objective for bull cow ratio. And these are the point estimates from the spring surveys. And as you can see, what's apparent from this is that we kind of have a chronic issue with being under the objective as we actually make the estimates of the bull-cow ratio. We recognize that, like a lot of places, bulls tend to be harder to count. They're in smaller groups. They're segregated from cows, which are the larger, easier detected groups. They also often have a tendency to use more cover and things like that. So it's entirely possible that we have some probably modest degree of underestimation here, but these are our best estimates. The big issue with clock and bull management is harvest vulnerability. We believe the data strongly suggests that we have a really vulnerable population to general season hunting, and that certainly contributes to this pattern. Tribal hunting occurs on the landscape. Nobody measures it directly. We don't know exactly what it is. We assume, probably rightfully so, that it's numerically smaller than our recreational hunting take, but we also don't necessarily think that it's a trivial source of mortality either. Obviously, one of the things that is a challenge for us and that we're continually trying to make improvements on is that we would like to offer more limited entry permit hunting for recreational hunters to actually be able to harvest the older branch antlered bulls. And these sorts of levels haven't allowed us to do that to the degree that we'd like. Because of the vulnerability issue, we've made two regulation changes in the last 20 years. So prior to 1994, the area was managed for general season hunting under an any bull regulation. Any antlered bull was a legal quarry for all hunters. That basically resulted in a herd, as you'd expect, with really low bull cow ratios and very few branch antlered bulls present in the post-hunt population. So in 1994, we introduced a spike-only regulation here. We have that regulation in place for two other large herds in eastern Washington. And under that regulation, a legal general season bull was a bull that had to have no more than a single point on one side. So a 1x2 like this bull would have been legal, 1x3, 1x4 even. 1x1s obviously, but was not required to have a spike just on both sides, only on one side. That still didn't get us to where we wanted to be with the bull cow ratio. It did show some improvement under that regulation. And so in an effort to recognizing the need to obtain a modest improvement even still on bull escapement, we went to the hunters and we polled them about what else we might do to improve that. We asked them to consider three options. One would be to shorten the season, reduce hunting days. Another option was to go to total permit entry for all general season, or it wouldn't be general season, but all bull hunting. Or the last one we offered was a true spike-only regulation, which we'd never had anywhere, which would basically mean that a legal bull under the general season rules would only be a one-by-one bull. The one-by-twos would now, and one-by-threes would now be not sub-legal. So the hunters basically weighed in and basically said that there was sort of substantial support for both the limited entry idea and the true spike idea. We sort of generally like to be able to offer general season hunting. I mean, we like the idea that people can go out and buy a tag every year if they want and not have to be lucky to go hunting. And so in 2009, we adopted a true spike-only regulation for the Clackam, and that's what we're currently operating under, but we haven't been doing it very long. This is just some the data for actual harvests. There's two lines on this figure. The red line is the trend in hunter numbers, and that corresponds to an x-axis on the left of the panel. The blue line is the actual general season bull harvest, and that's keyed to an x-axis on the right side of the panel. We flagged the spike-only regulation beginning here and the true spike-only regulation here. And what you can see from this, and one thing I just want to qualify, is that we changed the way we collect this data in 2001. And now we basically sample a very high proportion of our hunters for the data. Prior to 2001, we used a three-wave mailer system where we sort of randomly selected some hunters and got information from them. Prior to 2001, we were generating harvest data and effort statistics that were based typically on somewhere slightly less or some years slightly more than about 10% of the hunters. So we were sort of upscaling the estimates from that data. My point being is that it's a little difficult to sort of look across this timeline and assume that everything is completely comparative. I'm not saying that the data prior to this is no good. I'm just saying it was collected in a different way. One thing that's obviously apparent in the latter period here is that bull harvest has declined, but you'll also notice that numbers of hunters on the landscape has also declined. So the next panel is actually the harvest data removing the effect of the change in hunter numbers. And so basically what that sort of suggests is that up until the time we implemented the true spike-only regulation, in recent time under spike-only regulations, it fluctuates a bit, but a relatively flat trend in terms of the actual hunter take. It has gone down, but in fact that was sort of the design. I mean, we knew we needed to go down, and that was what the regulation was designed to do. So in terms of the percent of the yearling bulls that are actually harvested under the general season regulations, this panel goes back to 98 and through 2010. We don't have harvest data yet available for the last hunting season. And what you can see here is that we really have, as using the best data we have, our best assessment is that we do harvest a huge proportion of the spike bulls in this population through time. The actual average for this period here is 82% up until the true spike only regulations. We've only got 2 years of data to look at since the new regulation was put into effect, but the average right now is about 69%. So it has gone down. Again, it's probably a little early to make a definitive call on how well that's working. Just in terms of comparative purposes, so again, the true spike only or the regular spike only regulation produced an annual take of the yearling bull subpopulation of about 82%. In Yakima, using the same kind of data, we project that number to be more like 70%. And in the Blue Mountains, where we've actually measured this directly with telemetry and survival on the fates of radio-collared yearling bulls, that comes in at about 60%. So across the three populations where we have this kind of a regulation, the regular spike regulation, clearly a much higher proportion of the yearling bulls on the clock and we're dying every year. Another issue we have and a challenge we have on this landscape is elk and private lands. As you might know, in Yakima and also in the Blue Mountains, we have elk fences that are used to partly deter elk from going in places we don't want them to go. And in Yakima, we also have elk feeding that we use to try to, again, deter elk from going into areas where they would be problematic. We don't have that on this landscape in the Clackam. There are no fences, there's no feeding, there's nothing to keep an elk from going where it wants to go. So if an elk wants to go to the valley here, it gets to go to the valley here, and then we have to figure out another way to deal with it. Damage complaints have been chronic through time. They tend to go up and down year to year. And elk damage is obviously a source of conflict between people and interest groups. It also consumes both public and private resources, and those resources include time. Somebody's spending time to deal with elk. Money, both on the state side and also on the financial impact to private landowners. And when we have to use elk damage hunting as a tool to sort of deal with this, we also spend elk that we really hadn't intended to in that way. There's a lot of opinions on sort of what are the contributing factors that put elk on this part of the landscape where we have issues and have to deal with problems. One of those, it has a lot of local support. We heard, you may be familiar with what we call the Big Game Management Roundtable. It's kind of a local grassroots organization that we participate in, but we also created a sort of a venue for dialogue with various interest groups locally. And one of the things we heard a lot from landowners was that they really believe that levels of human activity on the public land part of this landscape may in fact promote elk use on private lands. They were essentially seeking security on private lands. And so sort of fitting with that, just to mention that there's been a lot of research over the years on elk in the West, and probably one thing that's been studied more than anything else is sort of the relationship of road densities and road use to elk distribution, and actually of more recent time, elk vulnerability to hunting and things like that. There's a little variation from landscape to landscape, but one of the things that's fairly consistent is that where elk have been hunted, they can, and where they can, they will select areas away from open roads. That doesn't equate to that we never see an elk on a road or near a road, and sometimes people think that that's what we're saying, but it really relates to the probability that an elk will use a piece of ground. And the reality is that when they have an option to use similar pieces of ground near and away from a road, they'll usually choose the piece that's further away from the road. So I would sort of generalize and say that elk are predictably refuge seekers when faced with high levels of disturbance, which again fits with this sort of notion we were getting from the local landowners that maybe part of the problem was just the level of human activity on the public land. In 2006, our wildlife area managers in this area began to try to quantify vehicle use on the road systems, and we started putting out road counters, and these dots actually are locations where we have put a buried magnetic vehicle detector. People don't know that's there. They don't know that their use is being quantified. But we've been collecting this data since 2006, trying to quantify the level of use on roads, not only on our ownership, but particularly on ownership, but on some other ownerships as well. This is data from the first year. This is at an entrance to the Kalakum known as the Corrals entrance. And one of the things that was really striking to us when we looked at these data was that we knew we had this kind of a peak in activity in the fall. This is clearly associated with hunting activity and people getting out on the landscape. But what was really striking from the data was that we had pretty much of equal magnitude and maybe longer duration this period in the spring where we also had an incredibly high use of the road system. It seems to be associated with a lot of things, some shed antler hunting, some just sort of cabin fever, and the weather gets nice and people want to go out and recreate, and again, this fairly open landscape, it dries out, snow goes away pretty early, people want to go out and look at wildflowers, whatever, but a lot of human activity in the spring, a lot more than I think we realized that we had. In some literature, the value of four vehicles passing a road in 12 hours has been considered a high level of road use, and if you use that standard, again, what this data suggests is that we're at or above a high level of vehicle use for a long time in the spring. So as a result of that, in February of 2008, for the very first time, we implemented an experimental winter range access closure that covered 40,000 acres. The closure pertained only to vehicle use, so motorized vehicles were prohibited. People could still walk out there. People could still ride a horse out there. The closure period was February 1st to April 30th, and again, non-motorized access still allowed. We're still under that sort of an experimental phase with that. The agency has not made a final determination on what to do with this regulation, but since 2008, every year we've had this closure in place. sort of just showing you where it is. This is basically all the Elk Winter Range on the Clallam. It's all this low elevation stuff that runs all the way to the Columbia River. And the closure area is this yellow outlined portion on this, basically the southern half of the Winter Range. A lot of things going on in the landscape that potentially have the possibility of influencing elk and elk habitat. Things like the development of a wild horse wind farm, which if you've driven I-90 to Spokane from here, you have seen. There's also plans underway right now to expand wind power development in the area. We had a land acquisition that occurred a short time ago where we blocked up some lands and filled in some gaps that were previously under other ownerships. We have the winter access closure that I just mentioned, and then we have this cooperative grazing management that really got underway quite a number of years ago, but turned into be a little bit more of a political hot potato than probably a lot of people realize it would be. And actually for this last year, we finally got it in place. All of these things are of fairly recent origin. The wind farm came on the landscape in 2006, 2008 for the land acquisition, 2008 for the closure, and 2011 for the grazing stuff. We also have a research study that's ongoing right now. I'm not sure if everyone is aware of that. This herd with this need was originally identified in the Clallam Elk Herd Plan. The major objectives include doing an evaluation of the connectivity of the core herd with the East Kittitas Valley subherd, which is one of these subherds that we do have sort of recurring issues with elk on private property. The effects of winter range closure and wind farm on elk movements and distribution. We're looking at cow survival and productivity. We're also looking at seasonal habitat selection for all seasons. The study was initiated in 2008, and it's designed to be a three-year study. We're in the final year of data collection on this current effort. The design basically has us monitoring 50 GPS collared cow elk per year. By the time we're done, we will have collected these data from 110 different collared elk. We move some of these collars around year to year onto different elk. And by the time we're done, we'll also have generated a data set that includes a little bit shy of 800,000 individual elk fixes, which is an enormous data set for us to work with. And with that, I'm going to turn it over now to my colleague, Will, and he's going to talk about the road exercise that he did for a while.
So again, my name is William Moore, and I'm a wildlife biologist in District 8, and me and my colleague, manage the Clallam Elk Herd, and I was given a task to do a road modeling exercise to quantify the influence of these roads across our herd. So basically, it was to try to predict influence of roads and trails across the on elk. Predict the influence of roads and trails on elk across the landscape. We wanted the model to be based in the current scientific literature, and basically this model didn't create any new research. It's just taking research that's been done in other states and applying it to the landscape of the Clallam. And we want the model to be able to evaluate the current road situation and also be very flexible so we could look at road management alternatives fairly easy. So the basis of the model was what we call the zone of influence. And the zone of influence is a percentage of the landscape that is affected by human disturbance for a given species. In this case, we're discussing the effects on elk by the human use of roads and the road and trail system across the Clallam herd range. And so you can see what we have here in red, or what we have actually in green, is that as a road, and then the influenced area is in red, and we can take that area and divide it by a defined area, whether that be a GMU, whether that be an elk's home range, or whatever we decided that we need to define it as, and times it by 100, and we get what we call the Z of I percentage. So this is basically what we're going to work to. I wanted to put it up front so you kind of get an idea of where we're headed. And so we will work back to this and look at how this is developed. So steps in developing the GIS model. Basically, we're going to have to deal with the roads layer, and we're going to have to classify that roads layer. We're going to discuss visibility and buffers. We'll also account for security cover. We'll come back to the metric of the model, the zone of influence, and discuss that once again. We'll look at the model results for the current condition, and then I'll run two hypothetical conditions just to show you how the model functions. And again, these are completely hypothetical options. We haven't discussed these at all about actually performing them. And so we needed some roads data, and we went to other agencies and took what they had, and then we also digitized roads off of aerial photography to get a complete roads layer, and basically we probably have the best road layer we can have for this area. In green there, we have open roads, and in red, we have closed roads. So you can see that there is a pretty high density of roads across some portions of this area. For the model, I basically classified them into two classes, open roads would be considered anything that you can travel on with a normal, let's say, four-wheel drive road usable, or even, you know, some are, you know, car accessible as well. So those would be classified as open. Closed roads has a pretty wide range, which would include hiking trails, motorcycle trails, ORV trails, which we considered closed. Private road access is considered closed in this as well as non-gated and gated roads that are considered closed. So for this exercise, we're just taking what we know is exactly open and what we know is and separating out to what we know is closed. So there's only two classes there. The model uses topography and looks at its effects on visibility. And so what it's going to do, you can imagine if you were standing on this ridge here, and just what you can see, the model will look out and say, that is going to be taken into the zone of influence. And it's going to exclude areas that you can't see. So in this slide on the left, the valley floors, would not be included in the zone of influence. And the slide on the right, being at the bottom of valley, those ridges would actually block your view, and so therefore the lands behind that would not be included in the model. So overall, topography will reduce the zone of influence and will potentially increase the real-world accuracy of the model, hopefully. But we don't actually want this to go out across the entire landscape. So we want to cut it down into areas that, you know, are influencing elk. And so there's been a lot of research out lately, and that research has been able to show that areas next to a road that's been used have a reduced probability of use. Areas that are further and further away have an increased probability of use. So what we're trying to capture with the buffers is just that reduced area, that reduced probability of use area. And that's where we're going to limit our zone of influence. We're going to look at two different buffers for different habitat conditions. So we have shrub steppe habitat, and as Scott mentioned, this is a fairly open landscape with a lot of open hillsides. And so we're going to buffer that differently than we're going than the forested habitats. So for the open roads or in shrub steppe, we're going to buffer those at 2,000 meters, and closed roads at 100 meters there. For forested habitats, the open roads will be buffered at 1,000 meters and the closed roads at 100 meters. This is a fairly moderate buffer level as compared to what's available in the literature. It's probably middle of the road. So also, the landscape does have quite a bit of forest on it, especially in the western portions. And so we're going to look at forest cover as security cover. And so we realize that, you know, when animals are in heavy conifer stands, they are not not visible to the average person driving by, and that does provide security. So basically, we defined our security cover as conifer stands greater than 70% canopy cover and greater than 250 acres in size. And so those are actually just removed out of the zone of influence, so it's going to decrease that zone of influence once again. So relative road impacts, And we can come back to this slide again. We're down to the zone of influence here. And you can start to get an idea. I mean, it's a real visual metric. We can see that that's probably somewhere around, let's say, 25% influenced. And the literature states that landscapes with less than 30% within the zone of influence is low impact, 30 to 50% is moderate impact, and greater than 50% is high impact. And so we're going to go ahead and look at the GMUs of the Tlacum. And you can start to see that we have a lot of red. And that red area is area that is influenced by the current road system. The white areas are areas which are not influenced. And it starts to become real obvious real quick. And you can see 249, obviously, the wilderness area has about a 5% zone of influence, and so is the lowest. Down in 329 down here, which is shrub steppe, and actually we own quite a bit of that land with our Tlacum, Quilmeen, and Whiskey Dick wildlife areas. And that is one of the highest zone of influence GMUs at 79%. And you can really kind of see, if anyone's familiar with the Tlacum, lots of ridges in the northern portion, and the topography starts to get a lot more moderate in the southern portion. And those buffers really start to expand out in that southern portion. 328 is next with about 78% influenced. And I would say 328 and 329 is really part of the core of the Tlacum herd. And you can see the canopy cover as we go to the west in 335 being pulled out. That's about 55% ZI. And the mission unit is, I believe it's 66%. So that GMU gave you us a large landscape look at how the landscape is influenced. But, you know, we're talking about elk, and so we want to deal with a much smaller scale as well. And so what I did is I took some data from the current Tlacum study, and you can barely see some of those small dots, but those are actually relocations on five different cow elk that are in a core area across the landscape there. And these are dates from mid-July till the first weekend of elk hunting season in the end of October. And so what I did is I created home ranges for those areas, and we will use that now to be our defined area. So we will compare the zone of influence within those home ranges. And I'm going to go ahead and use that as an average, so we'll just be dealing with one number instead of five numbers. And so there we have the five home ranges there, and the average ZI for that area is 72.5%. Well, so now we have what is our current condition is, and we wanted to be able to say, well, what about some alternatives? What would happen if we did, let's say, small road changes? And so I went ahead, and again, these are completely hypothetical. I went ahead and said, well, what if we just started closing some spur roads? And so we have five different spur roads closed. And, you know, the exact mileage I don't have, but some of them are small, some of them are larger. The zone of influence is still in red there. And when we close those, we can go ahead and see how that changes for the landscape. You can see up here this small spur that has other open roads proximate to it. We really didn't gain anything out of that. We go up here into this this larger, longer road. It gets away from those other open roads. We start to gain some. And when we get to these areas where we're looking at spur roads going into kind of like, what do I want to say, just more open spaces, they're jetting out into those open spaces, that we really start to see the gains. But for our five elk home ranges, we went from 72.5 to 69.7. So we really only changed the zone of influence by about 2.8% in that area with those small road changes. If we look at the larger road closure situation, obviously we'll probably get a larger result. I went ahead and kind of thought about, well, what if we wanted to go to the same areas, but we don't want to have redundant routes to those areas? And so as you can see, we can still move up through this valley, move up across the top, but we just can't do it in multiple ways. And there are some areas that are not accessible by motorized vehicle if we close roads like this. Again, the zone of influence will be in red. In blue, we're going to see the gains. of that. And so you can see when we start to expand that scope, we start to gain a lot more. And this takes us basically from that 72% of the original down to about 55.8 with a change of about 16.7%. So, some concluding points on this portion of the presentation. The consequences of Z of I effects are still being determined for Clockamelk, but would include effects on the probability of use, would include the increased energy expenditure for elk that are living in those areas, and would increase their vulnerability to harvest for elk that are living in those areas. I think the real point to this model is it will allow us to be able to combine it with the research that we're doing to be able to say where exactly are those high probability use areas and what if we decide to close some roads in that area, what would we be gaining? But overall, this will help us to balance road access and management gains for a variety of wildlife, as which elk would be included in that. We're back, Scott.
Okay, I'm gonna bring us home, and this won't take very long. We only have a couple more slides here. So, tying this road management exercise back to the elk herd plan, which is sort of our guiding document for elk management in the Clockam, road management is essentially one of the tools in which we can address habitat quality, potentially reduce disturbance. All the things that Will said about it, what would go into sort of making decisions on specifics about which roads would be closed and how you do it and when you do it, those are all yet to be determined. In the herd plan, road management, such as physically closing roads, is spending priority number four, if you actually have a herd plan and want to look that up. So in terms of a summary, some of the management challenges that we're sort of dealing with on an ongoing basis in the Clockam, one is one that I hit on early on, was to consistently achieve a level of escapement for yearling and older bulls important objectives, and included among those would be our ability to provide more adult bull hunting opportunity for our hunters. We continue to just deal with the uncertainty regarding tribal harvest. Again, there's no way to track that right now. There's no reporting scheme. They don't, the tribes themselves don't keep track of it. Develop a road management strategy that increases elk security during critical seasons. But one of the keys, I think, to being successful there is that to do that in a way that has broad support by some key landowners like DNR and also by the public. And certainly we'd like to replace antlerless damage removals that are sort of ongoing in recent time, replace that with recreational antlerless elk hunting opportunity, which has been pretty limited in the last several years on the Clockam. And as pretty much the case everywhere, we're sort of continuing to refine elk monitoring strategy and survey data collection, things like I mentioned with the photographing the large groups. Those are the kinds of tweaks that we make along the way to sort of improve our efficiency and just improve the quality of the data that we have to work with. And that's basically the presentation. So.
Very good. Very interesting. Okay. Questions? Commissioner Schmitten? Or... You ready?
I guess I'll start. Okay. Scott and Will, fantastic. From somebody that lives in that area. I had written a few notes down before I got here, kind of a lay perspective of the Clockam, and I can do this in 30 seconds. 1960, I hunted there for the first time. I've been up in the Clockam several times. That was 52 years ago. And it's always been an area that has abundant open areas. It has easy access, which resulted and still does in a strong hunting pressure with mostly road hunters, not exclusively. And it also seems like we've always had studies going on, and that's a tiny bit of a frustration, but I'm very impressed with what you're doing. You know, the three issues that I had, and boy, these are redundant, and they're interrelated. The low bull-cow ratio, too much road access. Then there's the two unknowns, and that's the tribal hunting, and there is some degree of non-tribal poaching. So what should happen? And I think you're striking on it, I guess. My concern is a bit impatient. I think the key thing, and the sooner you can complete, Will, your work and apply and reach an agreement on how broad it should be spread. The more roads that we can close, I think it's the more you're going to do to increase your low bull full cow ratio. I think you're going to increase the quality of the hunt. There are some difficulties. Certainly DNR is a partner that you have to deal with, but you know, there's two types of road closures. You're temporary, where you can select them for a certain period of time that takes care of some fire issues they may have and access, or permanent closures. But I like where you're going. I hope that you can get there sooner than later, because it's bull cow issue, if that's solved with the way the trajectory is going right now and overall herd population, you're going to have a first-class area.
Commissioner Caney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I love that presentation. And I've hunted all over the Clackam as well, and I might have started about in that same time period. I'm not sure. Maybe a little later. Couple of ideas, I guess, are just, I'm just going to throw this out. I hunt with a group of guys, and we really watched the statistics, and we watched our hunter success ratios and how they were going down over years and years, especially as spike hunting came into some of those areas in the Menasteh, where we used to hunt a lot. And then when it finally went to true spike, somewhere in that time frame, we did what I think a lot of hunters have done, is they've thought through their success rate in this state as an elk hunter and gone elsewhere. And I've hunted Idaho now and Utah. I still get a tag here. I think I'm doing what a lot of hunters are doing, is saying, well, I'll just keep putting in for my tag and get some points built up. And I have 12 points now. And we actually really strategized this through and said, well, one of us will put in for a hunt every year and two of us won't. We'll get the ghost permits. And if you get a tag, if you get drawn, we'll go help you get a big bull. And that's our season for the year. We won't hunt anywhere else. But the other two are just trying to gain points. And I guess I'm thinking this through a little bit, that somewhere in our state elk hunting mentality, I would hope that we can start to think about giving maybe more chances for hunters to stay in state. Maybe it's a way that they could pay more, and I know that's not always the best approach, but I'd be willing to pay a lot more for an elk tag if I knew I could get one every 6 years rather than 12 or 15, or I don't know when I'll get a branch antler permit in this state. And a lot of hunters are taking that option to just leave the state and not buy a tag. And I just hate to see that. So I think, you know, some of the things you're presenting is of road closures and maybe making a more quality hunt, or at least researching that and putting out studies that say, you know, what are you willing to put up with to have some type of a hunt here in this state again? And then I think as wolves move back into our systems, we're going to have to account for that as well. And I know one of the tactics we've had to change in hunting states that have wolves and elk is don't set up a base camp very much. Be mobile, because if wolves are there, why have a big wall tent set up? You're just going to have to take down because there's no elk around. And so this concept of having a traditional hunting location is what brings a lot of hunters still back up into the Clackam, into the Nanum. I've always hunted there. I want to go there. It's where I have a camp. We've always had a camp, but my hunter success rate is 2%. Well, eventually that 2% catches up in your head, and you think, I'd rather go hunt again rather than just camp. So anyway, I really like your presentation, and I would hope that we could look for some ideas along those lines as to keep more elk hunters in this state, of a variety of types of hunters, whether they want to be a cow hunter or a branched antler, but I think we're losing a lot.
Great. Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I guess I can tag on to Jay's and Raleigh's comments. I have not hunted this particular elk area, but I probably get more calls on the Clackam than any other area for the stakeholders, and they're 100% dissatisfied. And fact that we have had a 20-year decreasing harvest rate and hunter participation rate tells us that this isn't working, whatever we're doing. I noticed that, went to the Selkirk presentation tonight, and I noticed the bull-cow ratios are objectives are higher pre and post. The calf cow ratios are higher. This is one of the lowest we have. The calf rate recruitment rarely ever meets objective. So actually increasing this elk herd probably is not going to happen unless we're consistently above it instead of consistently below it. The road closure, I think, is definitely a solution. We've been, I think, looking into monitoring this herd since I've been on the commission, and I think we've studied it to death. We know that this thing isn't going in the direction we want, so I think we're more in a place where we got enough information, we should try something. And I think the stakeholders are expecting that. We're in an economic situation where we can't afford to have Jay go to Wyoming and Montana and Idaho to hunt. And we got to keep him home. And this is why it's so important to do it sooner than later. And I think as the wolf thing enters the clockum, if we got a problem with calving now, you have no idea what you're in for. And they're probably only 6 to 12 months away. So it's kind of alarming to look at that. But I'm not sure because the difficulty of surveying year to year, we can hang our hat on the data. But you look at the trends since 1994, you can kind of conclude that we've got issues and that it's time to... I think make some big changes. I think the stakeholders are willing to accept that. They're not going there now. They soon help us out. Road closures, permit only, no antlerless take, whatever we think we need to do to, I think, to start their trend going the other way as would be expected. The tribal issue, I don't know what the solution is, but it's certainly not satisfactory, and I don't know what efforts we're trying to do with them right now. And the feedback I get is that we have a spike-only population hunt so that we can raise antler bulls so the Indians can shoot them. And that's the reports that we consistently get back, that they're taking them out and we're raising them and we can't find the spikes to shoot. So I don't think the looking at your population spread, we're not getting the mature growth we should be getting. So something's wrong, and you would think that you would have similar response to the mature bulls as we have in the Blue Mountains after 18 years of spike only. So somebody's taking them. So maybe we need to look at what that balance is. If our co-partner in this works with us, it'd be great. What pressures we can bear there, but they too should start feeling the pain because this population is really headed in difficulty and stuff. So I like the study. It's the first time I've really seen road closures and maybe what the impact could be. So I don't know much more information we need to add to at least try to start making some changes. And so I would encourage the staff to take some bold steps here to try to get that population going. It's a huge success story. I mean, for hunters, that used to be a mecca for hunters to go to. And it's a gorgeous place to go hunt. It's nice terrain, and you basically don't have to walk straight up a mountain like you do in Montana half the time. So it's really attractive. So we should be increasing our participation there greatly instead of having it continue to go down. So I would be really interested in seeing some serious recommendations in this year's plan for next year to see if we can make some changes. And I think the road closure is a big start. And from there, it's open to you guys.
Great. Thanks. Commissioner Schmitten?
I just remembered one other thing I wanted to share. And again, it's a lay opinion, but I think it's a benefit from road closures. as you begin to narrow down to primary access zones, both from the south side and the north side, you can fairly easily camcord or put up video recorders. That would allow you to know out of season animals that are coming and going, either poaching or the data that you need from tribal. It's not 100%, and I wouldn't see it necessarily just for enforcement issues, but I would see it as wanting to know exactly what's occurring at all times. You already have in-road sensors, which we had a chance to see and understand. It wouldn't take very much to put recorders up if you could narrow the access.
Okay. One more question. What is required? How would you go about, would the commission need to make a decision on road closures? How would that work? How is the decision made?
Well, actually, that would probably come from another segment of the room, but I think the things that complicate sort of progress there, one has already been identified, and that is that the DNR is a major player on a big part of the landscape. So it's not like we can implement all our good ideas by ourselves. The other thing is that there is, locally, there is a divergent opinion on sort of road closures. I mean, we've got recently a couple of very small road closures that were recommended on the wildlife area, and we have gotten incredible opposition from a very small segment of the local population, but more or less willing to go to the mat over a couple of spur roads that aren't very long. So so that, you know, again, as I referenced earlier, I think part of the way you get to success is you have to sort of build enough broad public support that when you have a meeting to talk about what you're going to do, that you don't just have a bunch of people there that are opposed to it. So so part of it, I think, is sort of continuing education and just sort of developing partnerships. There is, you know, at the public meetings we've had of late on, for example, the winter range access closure, we've been getting probably a surprising amount of support for continuing that and sort of managing the access and providing some more security to elk during the winter. We've got people coming all the way from over here to go to public meetings in Ellensburg in the middle of the winter, which is pretty amazing to us. So I guess I'm sort of circling your question, but on our lands, I think, yeah, it's basically bringing recommendations to you guys, and you make decisions for things like DNR, and then it's sort of in the negotiation world. And trying to get them to do.
Director Anderson.
Thank you, Chair Wecker, and I do have the authority to close, have road closures on our property, and the road closures that we've talked about or have been come through my office, so it isn't something that needs to go through the commission. I do think that the land ownership issue, Department of Natural Resources getting their cooperation in this obviously is essential for these to be effective. We can't just do it on our lands and expect good results. I think the issue associated with tribal access to and whether or not they're being provided keys to gates is an issue that we will have to work through with DNR. So there are some big challenges in terms of using this strategy as a means of getting to where we want it to get to on in terms of our herd objectives and our bull cow ratios and those types of issues. I think we have the type of relationship with Department of Natural Resources that we can have those conversations that maybe we haven't had before. So I think the sooner we get our strategy and our plan laid out in terms of how we're going to use road closures to accomplish our herd objectives, the sooner we'll be able to engage at the right level with DNR.
Okay. Okay, terrific. Very, very good. Interesting. Thank you. Okay, we're scheduled for a break now. We're fairly far behind our schedule, but it's hopeless to catch back up, I think, unless our enforcement...
We're half an hour late, so I mean, we're not really behind schedule. We're sort of on schedule based on our decision to extend lunch.
Okay. So let's come back at 4 o'clock.